Chapter 31. Visitors. The Queen in White. Mercy. Woody and Claudia. Leaving Empus. 1. I spent a long time in a beautiful room with billowing white curtains. The windows behind them were open, letting in not just a breeze, but a reservoir of fresh air. Did I spend 3 weeks in that room? 4? I don't know, because they didn't keep weeks in Empus. Not our weeks, anyway. The sun came up and went down. Sometimes at night, those curtains were illuminated by the light of the shattered moons. The remains of Bella and Arabella had formed a kind of necklace in the sky. I never saw it then, just the shifting light through the billowing curtains of finest gauze. There were times when one of my nurses, Dora was the best, our lady of the shoes, would want to close the windows behind the curtains, lest night vapors make my already parlous condition worse, but I wouldn't allow it, because the air was so sweet. They obeyed, because I was the prince, and my word was law. I didn't tell any of them that I was reverting back to plain old Charlie Reed. They wouldn't have believed me anyway. Many people came to visit with me in the room of billowing curtains. Some of them were dead. Iota came one day. I remember his visit clearly. He dropped to one knee, put his palm to his forehead, then took the low chair beside my bed, where my gray nurses sat to scrape off the old poultices, which hurt, clean the wound, which hurt more, and then put on fresh poultices. That greenish muck, Claudia's creation, stank to high heaven, but it was soothing. That's not to say I wouldn't have preferred a couple of Advils. A couple of Percocets would have been even better.
"You look fucking terrible," I said.
"Thank you. Very kind."
"It was wasp venom that did for me," I said. "And the knife?" "You remember the knife and the man behind the door?"
"I did. Jeff. A good old American name. Or G-E-O-F-F, a good old British one."
"I had an idea Petra had tapped him for her consort once Eldon died, and she became queen of the realm."
"He probably had one of the gray men stick that knife into a nest long enough to get a good coating. Poor fellow was likely stung to death."
I thought that more than likely, if the wasps in Empus were as big as the roaches.
"But would that bastard care?"
Iota continued.
Nah, not that bitch's son. Wasps weren't so dangerous in the old days, but..."
He shrugged.
"Things changed once Flight Killer was in charge. For the worse."
"For the worse. Yeah."
He looked quite amusing, sitting in that low chair with his knees up around his ears.
"We needed someone to save us. We got you. Better than nothing, I suppose."
I raised my good hand and poked up the ring finger and pinky, my old friend Birdie's way of shooting someone the bird. Iota said,
"Petra's poison may not be as bad as what was slathered on that bastard's knife, but from the look of you, it was bad enough."
Of course it was bad. She had licked off the Eldon thing's drool, and that residue had been in her mouth when she bit me. Thinking of it made me shudder.
"Fight it," he said, getting up. "Fight it, Prince Charlie."
I didn't see him come in, but I saw him leave. He passed through the billowing curtains and was gone. One of the gray nurses came in, looking concerned. It was possible to discern expressions on the faces of the afflicted now. The worst of the deformities might remain, but the steady progression of the disease, the curse, had been arrested. More, there was slow but steady improvement. I saw the first tinge of color in many gray faces, and the webbing that had turned hands and feet into flippers was dissolving. But I didn't believe there would be permanent recovery for any of them. Claudia could hear again, a little, but I thought Woody would always be blind. The nurse said she'd heard me speaking and thought I might be lapsing back into delirium. I was talking to myself, I said. And maybe I was. Radar had never so much as raised her head after all. Claw dropped by for a visit. He didn't bother with the palm-to-brow salute, nor did he sit down, just hulked over the bed.
You cheated. If you'd played straight, I would have laid you out, prince or no prince.
What did you expect? I asked. You had at least 100 pounds on me, and you were fast. Tell me you wouldn't have done the same in my shoes. He laughed.
You got me there. I'll give it to you. But I think your days of breaking a fighting stick over anybody's neck are over. Are you going to get better?
Fucked if I know. He laughed some more and walked to the billowing curtains.
You've got some hard bark on you. I'll say that much.
And he was gone. If he was there at all, that is. You've got some hard bark on you was a line from an old TCM movie my dad and I watched during his drinking days. Can't remember the name of the film, only that Paul Newman was in it, playing an Indian. You think some of the things in my story are hard to believe? Try imagining Paul Newman as an Indian. That's a real credibility strainer. That night, or some other, I can't be sure, I woke to the sound of Radar growling and saw Kellen, the Lord High himself, sitting at my bedside in his fancy red smoking jacket.
You're getting worse, Charlie, he said. They tell you the bite looks better, and maybe it does. But that infection's gone deep. Soon you'll boil with it. Your heart will swell up and burst, and I'll be waiting for you. I and my troop of night soldiers.
Don't hold your breath, I said. But that was silly. He couldn't draw it, hold it, or let it out. He'd been dead even before the rats got to him. Get out, traitor. He did. But Radar continued to growl. I followed her gaze and saw Petra in the shadows, grinning at me with her filed teeth. Dora often slept in the antechamber, and she came running on her bowed legs when she heard my scream. She didn't raise the gas lights, but held one of those torpedo-shaped lanterns. She asked if I was all right and if my heart was beating regular, because all the nurses had been told to watch out for any changes in its rhythm. I said I was, but she took my pulse anyway and checked the latest poultice.
Was it ghosties, maybe?
I pointed to the corner. Dora padded over there in her splendid canvas shoes and raised the lantern. No one was there, but I really didn't need her to show me that because Radar had gone back to sleep. Dora bent and kissed my cheek as well as her bent mouth would allow.
All right. All right. Everything all right. Sleep now, Charlie. Sleep and heal.
2. I also had visits from the living. Kamet and Quilly, then Stooks, swaggering in as if he owned the place. His slashed cheek had been sewn up in a dozen looping black stitches. That made me think of a Frankenstein movie I'd watched on TCM with my dad.
Going to leave one hell of a scar, he said, rubbing at the stitches. I'll never be pretty again.
Stooks, you were never pretty. Claudia came often, and then one day, around the time I thought, yes, I'd probably live, Doc Freed came with her. One of the nurses was pushing him in a wheelchair that must have belonged to some king or other, because the wheel spokes looked like solid gold. My old nemesis, Christopher Polly, would have shit himself with envy. Freed's mangled and infected leg had been amputated, and he was clearly in great pain, but he had the look of a man who would live. I was delighted to see him. Claudia gently scraped away my current poultice and washed the wound. Then they bent over it with their heads almost touching.
"Healing," Freed pronounced. "Wouldn't you say?"
"Yes,"
Claudia shouted. She could hear again, a little, anyway, but I thought she might end up speaking in that toneless blare for the rest of her life.
"Pink flesh. No smell except from the widow's moss in the poultice."
"Maybe the infection's still there," I said. "Maybe it's gone deep." Claudia and Freed exchanged an astonished glance. The doc was in too much pain to laugh, so Claudia did it for him.
"What gave you a stupid idea like that?"
"No, huh?"
"Disease may hide, Prince Charlie," Doc Freed said. "But infection is a show-off. It stinks and postulates."
He turned to Claudia.
"How much of the surrounding flesh did you have to take?"
"Up to the elbow and almost down to the wrist. A hateful fucking gore she gave him, and it will leave a hollow where the muscle won't ever come back. Your days of playing games are probably over, Charlie."
"But you'll be able to pick your nose with both hands,"
Freed said, which made me laugh. It felt good to laugh. I'd had plenty of nightmares since coming back from the dark well, but laughter had been in short supply. "You should lie down and let someone give you some of that pain stuff they have," I told the doc. "Little leaves you chew up. You look worse than I do."
"I'm mending,"
he said.
"And Charlie, we owe you our lives."
There was truth in that, but not the whole truth. They also owed the snab, for instance. It had gone to wherever snabs go, although it might turn up in time. It had a way of doing that. Percival, however, was a different matter. He didn't come to see me on his own, so I asked that he be brought. He came into the room of the billowing curtains shyly, dressed in cook's whites and crushing a beret type of hat to his chest. I suppose it was an empresarian chef's toque. His bow was deep, his hand salute trembly. He was afraid to look at me until I offered him a chair and a glass of cold tea to drink. I thanked him for all he'd done and told him how happy I was to see him. That loosened his tongue, first a little and then a lot. He gave me news of Lillimar no one else had bothered to pass on. I think because he saw it from a working man's point of view. The streets were being cleaned, the rubbish and rubble were being picked up. Hundreds of people who had come to the city to help overthrow Eldon's rotten reign had left for their towns and farms, but hundreds more had replaced them, come to do their duty for Queen Leah before returning to their homes in places like Seafront and Deesk. To me, it sounded like the WPA projects I'd read about in school. Windows were being washed, gardens were being replanted, and someone wise in the ways of plumbing had gotten the fountains started, one by one. The dead, no longer restless, had been reburied. Some of the shops had been reopened. More would follow. Percival's voice was still slurred and garbled, sometimes hard to understand, but I'll spare you that.
"The glass in the three spires is changing by the day, Prince Charlie. From that ugly, dark green to the blue that it was in the old days. Wise folk, those who remember how things worked in the old days, are putting the trolley wires back up. It will be a long time before the cars are running again, and the damn things were always breaking down even in the best of times, but it will be nice to have them."
"I don't understand how they run," I said. "There's no electricity except for that little generator on one of the lower levels of the palace that I guess my friend Mr. Bowditch brought." Percival looked puzzled. He didn't understand electricity, which I think must have come out in English rather than Empresarian.
"Power,"
I said. "Where do the trolleys get their power?"
"Oh."
His face, lumpy but improving, cleared.
"Well, the stations give the power, of course. It's..."
And now it was a word I didn't understand. He saw that and made a waving gesture with one hand.
The station's on the river, Prince Charlie. On the streams, if there are big ones. And from the sea. Oh, there's a whopping station at seafront.
I think he was talking about some form of hydroelectric power. If so, I never found out how it was stored. There were many things about Empis that remained mysterious to me. Compared to how it could exist at all, and where, made the question of power storage seem picayune, almost pointless. 3. The sun came up, the sun went down. People came, people went. Some dead and some alive. The one I wanted most to see, the one who had gone to the well with me, didn't come. Until one day, she did. The goose girl, who was now a queen. I was sitting on the balcony beyond the curtains, looking down at the palace's central plaza and remembering unpleasant things, when the white curtains billowed out instead of into the room, and she stepped between them. She was wearing a white dress belted at her slim, still too slim, waist, with a fine gold chain. There was no crown on her head, but on one finger was a ring with a jeweled butterfly on its face. I guessed it was the signet of the realm, and served her when toting around a golden headpiece would have been too much trouble. I got up and bowed, but before I could put my hand to my forehead, she took it and squeezed it and placed it between her breasts.
Nah, none of that,
she said in such a perfect working man's accent that it made me laugh. Her voice was still husky, but no longer hoarse. A lovely voice, really. I guessed it wasn't how she had sounded before the curse, but it was fine.
Hug me, rather, if your hurt arm allows.
It did. I hugged her tight. There was a faint smell of perfume, something like honeysuckle. I felt as if I could have hugged her forever. I thought you wouldn't come, I said. I thought you'd cast me aside.
I've been very busy, she said,
but her eyes shifted away from mine.
Sit with me, my dear. I need to look at you, and we need to talk.
4. The half a dozen or so nurses who had been tending to me had been let go to perform other duties. There was no shortage of work in the weeks after the fall of the flight killer. But Dora remained. She brought us a large pitcher of Empissarian tea.
I'll drink a lot, Leah said. It doesn't hurt me to talk now, well, very little. But my throat is always dry. And my mouth is, as you see.
It was no longer sealed, but it was still badly scarred, and always would be. Her lips were healing wounds, lined with dark red scabs. The ugly sore she'd used to feed herself was almost entirely gone, but her mouth would never be completely mobile again, no more than Woody would regain his sight, or Claudia the full use of her ears. I thought of Stooks saying, I'll never be pretty again. Queen Leah of the Galleon never would be either, but that didn't matter, because she was beautiful.
I didn't want you to see me like this, she said. When I'm with people, which is all day, it seems, I have to keep myself from covering it. When I look in a mirror...
She raised her hand. I took it before she could put it over her mouth and set it firmly in her lap.
I'd be happy to kiss it, if it didn't hurt you.
She smiled at that. It was lopsided, but charming. Maybe because it was lopsided.
You're a bit young for love kisses.
I love you anyway, I thought.
How old are you?
This was an impertinent question to ask a queen, surely. But I needed to know what kind of love I'd have to settle for.
Twice your age, anyway. Perhaps more.
I thought of Mr. Bowditch, then.
You haven't been on the sundial, have you? You're not like 100 years old or anything.
She managed to look amused and horrified at the same time.
Never. No one goes on the sundial because it's very dangerous. When games and contests were played on the field of the monarchs, that will happen again, although there's much repair work to be done first. The sundial was locked in place, motionless, and guarded for good measure, lest someone from the thousands who came on those days be tempted. It's very old. Eldon told me once that it was here before Lilimar was built, or even thought of.
Hearing that made me uneasy. I bent down and stroked my dog, who was curled up between my feet. Radar's been on it. That's most of the reason I came, because Raids was dying, as you must know from Claudia.
Yes,
Leah said, and bent to pet Radar herself. Raids looked up sleepily.
But your dog is an animal, innocent of the bad strain that lives in the hearts of every man and woman, the strain that destroyed my brother. I'd guess that strain lives in your world, too.
I couldn't argue that.
No royal would go around on that even once, Charlie. It changes the mind and the heart. Nor is that all it does.
My friend Mr. Boditch wrote on it, and he wasn't a bad guy. In fact, he was a good guy. This was true. But as I looked back, I realized it wasn't completely true. Getting through Mr. Boditch's anger and solitary nature had been difficult. No, almost impossible. I would have given up if I hadn't made a promise to God. The God of my understanding, people in my dad's AA group always say. And I never would have known him at all if he hadn't fallen and broken his leg. He had no wife, no kids, no friends. He was a loner and a hoarder, a guy who kept a bucket of gold pellets in his safe and liked his old things, furniture, magazines, TV, vintage Studebaker in storage. He was, in his own words, a coward who had brought presents instead of taking a stand. If you wanted to be cruel, I didn't, but if you did, he'd been a bit like Christopher Pauly, which is to say, like Rumpelstiltskin. That wasn't a comparison I wanted to make, but was helpless not to. If I hadn't come, and if he hadn't loved his dog, Mr. Boditch would have died unremarked and unremembered in his house at the top of the hill. And with no one to guard it, the passage between the two worlds would certainly have been discovered. Had he never thought of that? Leah was looking at me, twirling her signet ring on her finger and smiling her lopsided little smile.
Was he good on his own? Or did you make him good, Prince Charlie?
Don't call me that, I said. If I couldn't be her prince, I didn't want to be anyone's. Nor was that even a choice. My hair was darkening again, and my eyes were changing back to their original color. She put her hand to her mouth, then forced herself to lower it to her lap again.
Good on his own, Charlie. Or were you his mercy from the high gods?
I didn't know how to answer her. I had felt older during much of my time in Empis, and sometimes stronger, but now I felt weak and uncertain again. Seeing Mr. Boditch without the softening filter of memory was a shock. I remembered how that old house at 1 Sycamore Street had smelled until I aired it out, sour and dusty, pent. She said, and not without alarm,
"You didn't ride on it, did you?"
"No, just pulled Radar off. And she jumped, too, but I felt its power. Can I ask you a question?"
"Yes, of course."
"The golden platform. We went up to go down, down those spiral stairs." She smiled a little, all she could manage.
"We did. It was risky, but we managed."
"Did the staircase between the walls go all the way to that underground chamber?"
"Yes. Eldon knew two ways. That and the one from the little room full of clothes. There may be others, but if there were, he never showed me.
So why did we go the long way? And almost fall, I didn't say.
Because, it was said, the flight killer couldn't walk more than a few steps. That made the stairs between the walls safer. And I didn't want to chance coming on to his party. But in the end, there was no choice.
If we hadn't stopped at the Lord High's apartment, Iota might still be alive.
We did what had to be done, Charlie. You were right about that. I was wrong. Wrong about many things. I need you to know that, and I need you to know something else. I'm ugly now, from the nose down.
You're not. She held up a hand.
Hush. You see me as a friend. I love you for it, and always will. Others don't, and won't. Yet, as queen, I'll have to marry before I grow much older. Ugly or not, there will be many willing to embrace me, at least with the lights out. And there's no need for kisses to produce an heir. But men who ride the sundial even a single turn are sterile, and women are barren. The sundial gives life, but it also takes it away.
Which explained why there were no little Bowditches, I supposed. But Petra.
Petra?
She laughed scornfully.
All Petra wanted was to be the queen of the ruin my brother created, and she was barren anyway.
She sighed and drank, emptying her glass and pouring another.
She was mad, and she was cruel. If Lilimar and Empis had been given into her grip, she would have ridden the sundial again and again and again. You saw how she was for yourself.
I had, and felt it. I was still feeling it, although her poison was out of my wound and the pain had been replaced by a deep itch Dora swore would go away in time.
Eldin was the other reason I was so slow in coming to see you, Charlie. Although thoughts of you have never left my mind, and I suppose they never will.
I almost asked her if she was sure I was too young for her, but didn't. For one thing, I wasn't meant to be a queen's consort, let alone a king. For another, I had a father who would be desperate to know I was still alive. There was a third reason for going back, too. The threat Gog Magog posed to our world might be over, at least for the time being. But there was also the threat our world would pose to Empis. If, that was, our world found out it was here, with all its untold wealth accessible from a certain shed in Illinois.
You were there when I killed my brother. I loved him as he once was. I tried to see him as he once was, but you forced me to see the monster he became. Every time I look at you, I remember him and what I did. I remember what it cost me. Do you understand that?
It wasn't a bad thing, Leah. It was a good thing. You saved the kingdom, and not so you could be queen. You saved it because it needed to be saved.
That's true, and there is no need for false modesty between the two of us who have been through so much, but you still don't understand. I knew, you see, that the flight killer was my brother. Claudia told me years ago, and I called her a liar. When I'm with you, I'll always know I should have done it sooner. What held me back was the selfish need to love his memory. While the kingdom suffered, I fed my geese and tended my garden and felt sorry for myself. You, I'm sorry, Charlie, but when I see you, I see my shame. That I chose to be a mute farm girl while my land and my people died slowly all around me. And all along I knew.
She was crying. I reached out to her. She shook her head and turned away, as if she couldn't stand for me to see her tears. I said, "Just now, when you came, Leah, I was thinking of a bad thing I did, a shameful thing. May I tell you?"
"If you like,"
still not looking at me. "I had a friend, Birdie Bird, a good friend, but not a good friend, if you see what I mean. I went through a hard time after my mother died. My father did too, but I didn't think very much about his hard time, because I was just a kid. All I knew was I needed him, and he wasn't there. I think you must understand that."
"You know I do,"
Leah said, and drank more tea. She had almost emptied the pitcher, and it was a big one. "We did some bad things, Birdie and I. But the one I was thinking of, there was a park we used to cut through on our way home from school, Kavanaugh Park, and one day we saw a crippled man there, feeding the pigeons. He was wearing shorts and had big braces on his legs. Birdie and I thought he looked stupid. Robo dude, Birdie called him.
I don't know what that
Never mind, it doesn't matter. He was a crippled man on a bench, enjoying the sun, and Birdie and I looked at each other, and Birdie said, "Let's swipe his crutches." I guess it was that strain you talked about, the evil. We swooped down and took them, and he yelled at us to bring them back, but we didn't. We took them to the edge of the park and threw them in the duck pond. Birdie threw one and I threw the other, laughing the whole time. We threw the crippled man's crutches in the water, and how he ever got home, I don't know. They splashed, and we laughed. I poured the rest of the tea. It only filled half the glass, which was good because my hand was shaking and my eyes were streaming. I hadn't cried since I cried for my father in Deep Moline.
"Why do you tell me this, Charlie?"
I didn't know when I started. I thought that was one story I'd never tell anybody, but I knew now. "I stole your crutches. All I can say in my defense is that I had to."
"Ah, Charlie."
She touched the side of my face.
"You couldn't be content here anyway. You're not of this world. You're other. And if you don't go back soon, you'll find yourself unable to live in either."
She stood.
"I must go. There's much to do."
I walked her to the door. In eighth grade, we studied haiku in English class, and one of them came back to me then. Very gently, I touched one finger to her scabbed mouth. "When there's love, scars are as pretty as dimples. I love you, Leah." She touched my lips as I had touched hers.
"I love you too."
She slipped out the door and was gone. 5. The next day, Eris and Jaya came to visit, both wearing coveralls and big straw hats. All who worked outside were now wearing hats because the sun shone every day, as if to make up for the years of clouds, and everyone's skin, not just those of us who had spent a long time in Durance Vile, was fishbelly white. We had a pleasant visit. The women chattered away about the work they were doing, and I told them about my recovery, which was almost complete. None of us wanted to talk about Deep Moline, or the Fair One, or the Escape, or the Night Soldiers. Certainly not about the dead we'd left behind. They laughed when I told them how Stooks had swaggered in. I forebore telling them about my midnight visits from Kellen and Petra. Nothing funny about those. I learned that a party of giants had come from Cratchy to pledge fealty to the new queen. Jaya spied my pack and knelt before it, gliding her palms over its red nylon body and black nylon straps. Eris was kneeling beside Radar and gliding her hands through her fur.
"Ooh," Jaya said. "This is fine, Charlie. Was it made where you came from?"
"Yes. In Vietnam, most likely."
"I'd give a dear lot to have one like."
She lifted it by the straps.
"And so heavy. Can you carry it?"
"I'll manage," I said, and had to smile. Damn right it was heavy. Along with the clothes and Radar's monkey, it contained a solid gold door knocker. Claudia and Woody had insisted I take it.
"When do you leave?"
Eris asked. "Dora tells me that if I can walk to the city gate and back without fainting tomorrow, I can go the day after."
"So soon?"
Jaya asked.
"Too bad. There are parties at night, you know, when the day's work is done."
"I guess you'll have to party hardy for both of us," I said. That night, Eris returned. She was alone. Her hair was down. She was wearing a pretty dress instead of her working clothes. And she didn't waste time or words.
"Will you lie with me, Charlie?"
I said I would be happy to lie with her, if she would excuse any clumsiness on account of me not having had the pleasure so far in my life.
"Lovely,"
she said, and began to unbutton her dress.
"You can pass on what I teach you."
As to what followed, if it was a thank you fuck, I didn't want to know. And if it was a mercy fuck, all I can say is hooray for mercy. 6. I had two more visitors before I left Lillimar. Claudia came in, leading Woody by the elbow of a black alpaca coat. The scars on Woody's eyes had loosened and pulled apart, but what I could see in the gaps was nothing but white.
"We came to wish you well and to thank you," Claudia boomed.
She was close to Woody's left ear, and he pulled back with a little wince.
"We can never thank you enough, Charlie. There will be a statue of you near Elsa's pool. I have seen the drawings, and they are quite..."
"Elsa's dead with a spear in her guts." I didn't realize I was angry with them until I heard my voice. "Lots of people are dead. Thousands, tens of thousands, for all I know, while you two sat on your hands. Leah, I understand, she was blinded by love. She couldn't bring herself to believe her brother was the one who did all this shit. But you two believed. You knew. And still you sat on your hands." They said nothing. Claudia wouldn't look at me, and Woody couldn't.
"You were the royals. The ones left, other than Leah. The ones that mattered, at least. They would have followed you."
"No,"
Woody said.
"You're wrong, Charlie. Only Leah could rally them. Your coming caused her to do what a queen must do. Lead."
"You never went to her? Told her what her duty was, no matter how much doing it might hurt? You were older, presumably wiser, and you never gave her counsel?"
More silence. They were whole people and thus not cursed with the gray, but they had suffered their own afflictions. I could understand how that had weakened them and made them fearful, but I was still angry.
"She needed you."
Claudia reached out and took my hands. I almost pulled them away, then didn't. In a soft voice she probably couldn't hear herself, she said,
"No, Charlie. You were the one she needed. You were the promised prince. And now the promise has been fulfilled. What you say is true. We were weak. We lost our courage. But please don't leave us in anger. Please."
Did I know before then that a person can choose not to be angry? I don't think I did. What I knew was that I didn't want to leave that way either. All right. I spoke loud enough for her to hear. But only because I lost your three-wheeler. She sat back with a smile. Radar had put her nose on Woody's shoe. He bent over to stroke her.
We can never repay your courage, Charlie. But if there's anything we have that you want, it's yours.
Well, I had the door knocker, which felt like it weighed about 4 pounds, and if the price of gold now was roughly the same as it had been when I left Sentry, it was worth about $84,000. Added to the pellets in the bucket, I was pretty well set. Living large in the hood, as they say. But there was one thing I could use. How about a sledgehammer? Not exactly what I said, but they got the idea. 7. I'll never forget the terrible winged thing that tried to emerge from the dark well. That's a bad memory. A good one, to balance it out, was leaving Lillimar the following day. Now, good isn't good enough. It's a fine memory. The sort you take out when no one has a kind word for you and life seems as tasteless as a slice of stale bread. It wasn't fine because I was leaving, although I'd be a flat liar if I didn't say how much I was looking forward to seeing my dad. It was fine because I was given a send-off that was fit for... I was going to say fit for a king, but I guess what I mean is fit for a departing prince who was reverting back to a suburban kid from Illinois. I was riding shotgun in a cart pulled by a pair of white mules. Dora, wearing her red headscarf and her fine canvas shoes, held the reins. Radar sat behind us, ears up, tail swishing slowly back and forth. Both sides of the galleon road were lined with gray folk. They knelt with their palms to their foreheads as we approached, then stood and cheered as we passed. My surviving mates from Deep Maline trotted beside us, Eris pushing Doc Freed in his gold-accented wheelchair. She looked up once and tipped me a wink. I tipped her one right back. Above us flew a cloud of monarch butterflies, so thick they darkened the sky. Several lit on my shoulders, wings flexing slowly, and one touched down on Radar's head. Standing at the open gate, wearing a dress the same deep blue as the triple spires had become, the crown of the galleons on her head, was Leah. Her legs were planted apart in a way that reminded me of how she had stood on the stone stairs above the dark well, sword drawn, resolute. Dora gigged the mules to a stop. The crowd that had followed us fell silent. In her hands, Leah held a garland of blood-red poppies, the only flowers that had continued to grow during the gray years, and it did not surprise me, nor will it you, I think, to know that the people of Empis called those flowers Red Hope. Leah raised her voice to be heard by those crowding the street behind us.
This is Prince Charlie, who now goes to his home. He carries our thanks with him and my enduring gratitude. Speed him with love, people of Empis. This is my command.
They cheered. I bent my head to receive the garland and to hide my tears. Because, you know, in the fairy tales, the prince never cries. Queen Leah kissed me, and although her mouth was broken, that was the best kiss I've ever had. At least since my mother died. I feel it still.